Hi, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 19th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And we begin the show today with a history lesson.
Korea is a small country, thousands of miles away. But what is happening there is important to every American.
That bit of old tape that you're listening to is President Harry S. Truman in 1950 addressing the American people a month after communist North Korea invaded the South and the subsequent U.S. invasion. That was the Korean War, of course. 3 years and an estimated 2.5 million deaths later, the Korean DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, was established between the North and the South, a temporary solution until a peaceful settlement was achieved. Well, that peaceful settlement has never really come. There is still technically a state of war between the North and the South. And 67 years later, while the Korean War is now just an afterthought here in the United States, it remains very much alive on the Korean Peninsula, both in the minds and in the politics of both the North and the South. For our part, Americans are wondering once again what to make of the supposedly brutal North and unsure what Washington plans to or should do about it.
North Korea would do well not to test his resolve or the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region.
That's the American Vice President there, Mike Pence, speaking in South Korea on Monday after his visit to the DMZ, sounding a little bit like President Truman nearly seven decades ago. To help us walk through some of the history here of this current Korean moment is Bruce Cummings. He's history professor at the University of Chicago. He's also author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. Bruce, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, how far do we have to go? We just went back 70 years. Do we have to go back quite that far to understand the current flashpoint and the current escalation in relationship between the North and the South?
Well, strangely enough, we have to go back even farther because in 1945, the U.S. Sent 25,000 combat troops into southern Korea to establish a military government that lasted 3 years and deeply shaped post-war Korean history. State Department documents show that our decision to occupy Korea was taken primarily because of worries about guerrillas like Kim Il-sung coming down from Manchuria and taking over all of the peninsula with Soviet help. The State Department thought about 35,000 Korean guerrillas were fighting the Japanese during World War II. It was high in the 1930s, but maybe 200 survived, and they came back and formed the government of North Korea and continue with their progeny to form the elite in North Korea. So essentially, we've been dealing with the Kim family for 72 years, trying to prevent them from taking over the whole peninsula. And now we have the grandson armed with nuclear weapons and at least short and medium-range missiles. So as an historian, it's hard for me to see this as a success. It is actually a long-running failure to engage North Korea, as you indicated earlier, also to end the Korean War with a peace treaty, and try and normalize a situation that has been extremely tense, really, for 72 years.
Bruce Cummings, you're a historian, and that's why we have you here. It seems sometimes like you could really use a theologist to get inside the mind and the psyche of North Korea. I mean, you've got a holy trinity here that goes back longer than 70 years, as you described, the grandfather, the son, and now the grandson. It really is almost a religious devotion, even though they're officially atheist.
Well, I think there are religious aspects to the virtual worship of the Kim family, but it fundamentally plays off Korea's thousands of years of monarchy. You have a royal family named the Kims, and this is a people that has never experienced anything but monarchy or dictatorship. They had 40 years of dictatorship under the Japanese. Then Kim Il-sung took over, and you've had 72 years of dictatorship under that family. So in many ways, North Korea plays off a very long history, drawing deeply on Korean political culture, worship for the king. There's all sorts of lore and poems and songs and everything about pre-modern Korean kings. I actually think it's one of the things that gives strength to the system, even though it's hardly democratic and hardly a free country.
Was an escalation at this point something that you might have expected when you look at the long arc of the relationship between the North and the South in the United States? I mean, you have a new president in the U.S. That's a time when a foreign power or a foreign country might want to probe a little bit. You also have a recent political crisis in the South with the impeachment of the president there. Was a flare-up maybe something we might have expected right now?
Yes, I have to say I wouldn't have expected it so soon. But what we've had with every new administration is, as we already discussed, obligatory visits to the DMZ, where Vice President Pence or Secretary of State Tillerson a couple of weeks ago flex their muscles and stare at the North Koreans. It's a classic photo op, and it's just been going on for decades to the point where it's almost boring. The same rituals on our side applied every time. You also, with new administrations, at least for the last 25 years, always get the idea that the previous administrations have failed in regard to North Korea to rein in its nuclear program, but we're not going to let that happen. And so Donald Trump is following very closely on the heels of President Obama and President Bush, President Clinton, all trying to deal with this problem. And all of them, and I think also President Trump, sooner or later come up against the hard fact that there isn't a military solution on the Korean Peninsula. The North Koreans have an army almost as big as ours. It's 1.3 million. Ours is 1.4 in all military branches. They're dug in like you wouldn't believe, with 15,000 underground facilities of a national security nature. They have mobile short-range and medium-range missiles. They have 10,000 artillery guns in the mountains north of Seoul. I mean, it's just an unbelievable phalanx of military power that the North Koreans present. And even though many of their weapons are old or even obsolescent, there isn't an American president that really wants to challenge them on their own ground.
So inside the North Korean psyche, you can pick somebody in the military apparatus if you like, or even the common citizen. Maybe those are two different things. How important is military escalation or a flexing of North Korean muscle in the face of the enemy United States for the regime to keep its power and keep its legitimacy here?
Well, it's their stock and trade, and they go so far as to threaten nuclear attacks against the American mainland, which I don't think they can muster. Their belligerence is a flip side of deep insecurity. They're surrounded by powers that at best are not friendly. Russia and China used to have a close alliance with North Korea, but that ended with the end of the Cold War. You have South Korea with 700,000 soldiers under arms. Japan and North Korea have had a terrible relationship going back to 1945. We thought we saw the carrier Vincent task force steaming into Korean waters. This morning we learned it's somewhere down near Australia.
Right.
But that's the kind of thing that North Korea has faced. It's, I think, important sometimes to just step back and say, what if this is the greens against the blues instead of the reds against the anti-reds, and see that North Korea is a small, besieged country. Not just from their point of view. I think it's fair to say they've been besieged for a very long time, particularly in the last 25 years when they haven't had an ally that they can count on. And so they project a ferocious image. I would also say that one of the errors that just constantly creeps into American commentary on North Korea is to think that Kim Jong-un, this 33-year-old, runs everything, and that if we could somehow take him out, everything would work out after that. When you look at him last weekend on the TV platforms where he's standing with his aides and colleagues, most of the men there, particularly the military men, were well over 60. The titular president of the country is in his 80s. These are people who go back to the Korean War and have deep experience and have been schooling Kim Jong-un for some time, just as his father did. You could lop off his head and you would have another person appear who is running the regime in essentially the same way, because as the Kim family has consolidated power, they've married into other former guerrilla families. They've sent their kids to the best schools. Koreans really know how to do this, and over 70 years, they've created a rock-hard elite that rarely shows any fissures. So it's not the case that an assassination of Kim Jong-un or even two or three of the top leaders would make much of a difference, in my view.
Well, that's the possibility of regime change in North Korea, Bruce Cummings, which you say is probably remote, at least from a military perspective. But before we let you go, let's talk about the South just for a second. Our ally that relies on American messages of strength and backing them up. And of course, they're in the middle of an election, too, having just impeached their president. And you mentioned the USS Vinson carrier strike group, which was never headed into Korean waters. I just have to bounce something off of you because I caught a statement from one of the presidential candidates in South Korea, Hong Jun-pyo, who said that what Mr. Trump said was very important for the national security of South Korea. He's talking about this carrier strike group. If that was a lie, then during Trump's first term, South Korea will not trust whatever Trump says. Is that just sort of light anti-American campaigning in South Korea, or is that something more serious?
Well, over the weekend, when there was all this tension, the Washington Post reported that most South Koreans seemed more worried about Donald Trump than they did about Kim Jong-un. And I think it's an important thing that whether it's by design or not, Donald Trump has managed to make himself a very unpredictable figure. Churchill in World War II said that the truth during war should be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. And in the case of Trump, he has a bodyguard of lies, half-truths, misstatements, flip-flops that are unlike any president, I think, in American history. There could be method to his madness in that this gives him a lot of freedom to be unpredictable, but it also makes him so slippery and difficult to predict for other people. As to what that candidate said, I think, as far as I can tell, the whole story of the task force steaming toward Korean waters was a result of several foul-ups by the Navy and the Pentagon. And I think there are many more important things that South Koreans have to worry about than just this particular foul-up.
Well, in a 70-year-old confrontation filled with unpredictability, sometimes being able to predict the statements or actions of your adversary goes a long way to maintaining the peace on the Korean Peninsula. Bruce Cummings, history professor at the University of Chicago, also author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, you've heard a lot about water trouble in Michigan, and here's a new chapter. It's not about contaminated pipes in Flint, at least not directly. This chapter has to do with bottled water. Nestle, the big company, extracts billions of dollars worth of groundwater from western Michigan, but it pays the state just $200 a year in paperwork fees for that privilege. Now, Nestle wants to more than triple its pumping capacity in the region from 150 gallons per minute to 400 gallons per minute. And locals and activists say the pumping could cause damage to the surrounding wetlands. And people have pointed out the irony that you might already be thinking of, that Flint residents are stuck buying water, maybe from Nestle, while the company pumps it out essentially for free. Logging companies and ranchers have to pay a fee when they use public resources on government land. So why does Nestle get to make potentially billions of dollars off of essentially free water? That's a question that's baffling to Liz Kirkwood. She's executive director of FLO. That stands for the Love of Water. They're a Great Lakes Water and Policy Center.
That is the question of the hour. Why is it essentially free? And because the state has not addressed the issue about bottled water. In the state's water withdrawal law of 2008, bottled water is an exception. And one of the recommendations that we and others have made is to place a moratorium on any further permits for bottled water to examine this issue. Ontario, Canada, for example, has a two-year moratorium because they are facing the same issue. And if we don't get it right now, it will open the doors wide for other multinational corporations to come in.
So this is going to be a different issue for residents of Flint, certainly residents of Michigan more broadly, Liz. How do you want outsiders to look at this when they look at the groundwater situation in Nestle?
I think this issue highlights the critical importance for people to start making clear connections about water privatization, to understand what it actually means and the detrimental effect and the corrosive effect it has on our failing municipal water systems and the urgent need to commit to transforming and reinvesting in our municipal water systems across the country. And we're looking at a $1 trillion investment over the next 25 years.
You know, Liz, a lot of people might see a perverse set of incentives here when they look at this story. I mean, we're so behind on water infrastructure, not just in Flint, but in dozens, hundreds of communities across the country. The worse the water out of your tap feels to you, or the worse you perceive it, gosh, the more likely you are to buy a bottle of Deer Park water down at Walmart, right? That doesn't seem right. like the right set of incentives.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, following the Flint disaster, one out of three people interviewed, I think it was in the Christian Science Monitor, one out of three people were likely to only have faith in the local municipal water and we're going to drink out of the tap. It's disasters like Flint that trigger the fear amongst the public.
And to put a fine point on it, Liz, do companies like Nestle, and I don't want to impart any motives to them that I'm not aware of, but do companies like them have at least a vested interest in declining public confidence in municipal water?
Well, I think that that's a question for them. You know, Nestle has, you know, indicated on their website that they've contributed to the Flint disaster donating bottled water. But the rise of bottled water in this century is unprecedented. And it, you know, it has a lot of deleterious effects, not only on kind of eroding trust in public infrastructure, but the whole ecological impact, of course, of using plastic, fossil fuel-based bottles that are end up in our landfill. And water is a public resource. The law across all 50 states requires each and every state to be the public trustee on behalf of all citizens. And this legal duty must come first and foremost. The human right to water was ratified by the UN in 2010. And we know that this is a life and death issue. And this is a cross-cutting issue across all economics that disproportionately harms vulnerable communities. And so it's imperative that we get this right, that we manage our water, that Michigan, you know, for example, with bottled water, there was a recent audit. They're not even keeping track of every gallon of water that's going in and out of the state. This is our most valuable resource, especially here in the Great Lakes, where we have 20% of the planet's fresh surface water. So if we don't get it right now, I don't know when we will.
An ongoing battle in western Michigan as Nestle seeks to vastly increase the amount of water it's pumping out of the ground. For resale to you in bottled form, Liz Kirkwood, Executive Director of For the Love of Water, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We reached out to Nestle for a comment or an interview for this story. If they get back to us, we will certainly put them on the air. Former New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez reportedly has committed suicide in prison. That was earlier today. Prison officials in the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in Shirley, Massachusetts, discovered his body hanged in his cell. It is an abrupt end to a very long story for Aaron Hernandez, once a rising star in the NFL, who was serving a life sentence without parole for the murder of Odin Lloyd in 2013. Just last week, Hernandez had been found not guilty in a second murder case, a double murder drive-by shooting that occurred in Boston in 2012. And in perhaps another stroke of irony, one that certainly will not be lost on the news media, the New England Patriots, Aaron Hernandez's team, appearing at the White House today to celebrate their most recent Super Bowl win with the President of the United States. Michelle Steele is a reporter for ESPN and joins me now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm well, but it's a disturbing story. The Aaron Hernandez story has been disturbing almost from the start. What are authorities making, if anything, of his death, of his suicide? What do we know?
What we know at this point is that he was discovered in a single cell. He was in the general population of this Massachusetts prison However, he was sleeping in a cell by himself, and it was locked. In fact, he had taken various items and sort of jammed the door from the inside. It was his attempt to block the door from the inside, and he was discovered hanged by his own hands around 3 o'clock in the morning. Around 4 o'clock in the morning, when he was brought to the hospital, he was pronounced dead. Just a surreal end in the sports world to a very surreal story.
And has there been any indication from prison authorities that Aaron Hernandez had any other precipitating events, clashes with other inmates, or suicidal thoughts or behavior or threats or anything like that leading up to this moment?
You know, when he was first put in prison, this was in 2013, he was charged with the murder of one person, Odin Lloyd, who was an acquaintance of his. And I remember at the time when I was covering that story, people were talking about how he had a very businesslike approach to prison, almost like he was in training camp in the NFL. He continued doing his exercises. He had a very sort of upbeat, let's call it, demeanor, according to people who I talked with. And in fact, as recently as last week, I was talking to a source who had seen him in the courtroom for this next murder trial. Remember, he was just acquitted last week of murdering two other people in 2012. And they told me that his demeanor was as normal seeming as it could be, you know, joking with the attorneys at one point, talking to the courtroom employees. You know, one potential juror made a Deflategate reference at one point, and he smiled about that.
What are you taking away from our approach to criminal justice or even the way we interpret sports stars in our culture? Did we learn anything from this horrible episode?
I was speaking to someone who is very close to the family, and this was around the time that he was convicted of first-degree murder in 2015 for the murder of his acquaintance, Odin Lloyd. And they told me Aaron had a winning lottery ticket. He was someone who was a world-class athlete. He had been to a Super Bowl. He had just signed a $40 million contract, Todd. And all of it was thrown away.
And Michelle Steele, it should be said, an eye-opener and a tragedy will be more in the front of the public's eyes. The New England Patriots are set to visit the White House and visit the president today for last year's Super Bowl win.
Todd, talk about timing. They will certainly get many questions shouted at them from the press corps, Bill Belichick, the coach, and Robert Kraft, the owner, about what has happened to their former player.
Michelle Steele, reporter for ESPN. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Earlier this week, a federal judge in Arkansas stayed the scheduled executions of two of the seven men on that state's death row. Arkansas wanted to push through the executions because the drug used in lethal injections there is set to expire. Now, amid all the rush, legal wrangling over the mental health of two of the condemned men is what halted Monday's executions. The next two are planned for Thursday, and the court has ruled for now that those two executions can go forward. In Arkansas, there's little doubt over guilt, but there's continued skepticism over due process and how many death row inmates have seen their time run out with no second chances to prove their innocence. In Oklahoma, meanwhile, death row inmate Richard Glossop has faced execution three times. He says he's innocent, and he hopes that a new documentary reinvestigating his case will help prove it.
You're not allowed to take anything with you but addresses and phone numbers, your Bible. Your day is pretty much sitting there waiting for that day to happen, waiting for them to come and get you, to strap you in and to finally end, you know, your life.
Joe Berlinger is director of the Investigation Discovery TV documentary Killing Richard Glossop. John Hockenberry spoke with Joe Berlinger about the profile. It's all about what due process has meant for the Oklahoma death row inmate.
He's the poster child for everything that could go wrong in the system and everything that can go wrong by having a death penalty. You know, here's a guy who never did a crime before. And the confessed murderer, a guy named Justin Sneed, who was the motel maintenance man, who was a meth addict, whacked this guy repeatedly over the head in a botched robbery attempt. And then the police, and you see it in the interrogation tapes, the police encouraged him to finger Richard Glossop as the guy who actually hired Sneed. Why? Because murder for hire is a capital offense. Mm. And so this elevated this to the death penalty because the prosecutor at the time, a guy named Bob Macy, had 54 death penalty notches on his belt, and they were going for the death penalty. So right from the start, this guy's case was deeply troubled. All of his post-conviction appeals process was deeply flawed. And then the thing that blew my mind and what made me wanted to tell his story is his odyssey on death row exemplifies everything that's wrong with the death penalty system. You know, this is a guy who's had three last meals. In Oklahoma, there's a 35-day process. When you're about to be executed 35 days before, you go from your regular death row cell to an area that's even more deprived. One meal, lights on 24/7, you're always being watched, your mattress is thinner. I mean, they basically just want you to give up so you die. And so many people in the innocence community believe he's innocent.
What does Glossop say?
Oh, Glossop has maintained his story consistently from the start, that he's innocent, he had nothing to do with this crime. Meanwhile, the confessed killer, and I got to talk to both of them in person, has changed and manipulated his story multiple times. There's no corroborating evidence.
So what is the provenance? What's the origin of these laws that say you can't look at evidence? When Americans would think in the court system at every level, well, what else are you looking at? I mean, what?
Well, you know, there's this bizarre concept of the finality of judgment. You'll hear that a lot. Like, you know, when new evidence comes up after 20 years, the governor of Arkansas, you know, is saying it now, and the attorney general for Arkansas, we're going to, you know, this is a travesty for the families. They've been waiting 25 years for this, you know. And look, I'm incredibly sympathetic to victims' families, but it's just emblematic of a system that will allow innocent people to be killed.
You had feelings about this case, which got in the way of your camera.
There's no room, I think, in this instance for letting people make up their own mind, which is my usual journalistic style. This is a guy who's exhausted all of his appeals. Clemency's been denied. His execution could be as early as the summer of, you know, this summer. I've looked deeply into the case, and I've never seen such a case that lacked such evidence. There's no physical evidence linking Glossop to the crime scene. The case really is a he said, she said, or rather a he said, he said. I mean, classic jailhouse snitch trying to make their situation better. It's just a classic situation in the criminal justice system.
I think that so much of our critique and, you know, 21st century look at what's going on in America intersects with the criminal justice system. Yeah. It's almost the whole story of our national identity right now. Can we fix it? Do we understand what's happening there?
Yeah.
How does this story add to that big, huge narrative?
Yeah, well, there are lots of problems in the criminal justice system, as we know, over-sentencing, you know, bad use of plea deals, forcing people of color and impoverished people to accept crimes that they didn't necessarily commit because they got a bigger crime hanging over them. But the biggest problem in our criminal justice system, because it involves killing people, is the death penalty. And what's going on in Arkansas really has shined a light on all the problems that are going on with the justice system.
And it's not an issue of do you support the death penalty or do you not support the death penalty. It's looking at this death penalty that's become a kind of killing mill. I mean, yes. Arkansas is about, well, we've got to get rid of these people. Let's just off them before the expiration date.
Right. The drugs are hard to procure, and there's a reason for it, in particular midazolam, which has been sold as a humane way of killing people. You know, in Oklahoma, we've seen with Charles Warner and Clayton Lockett, these people writhing in pain. I mean, Lockett took 45 minutes to die. Warner said his body's on fire. And look, these are terrible crimes. And so some people may be saying, well, let them suffer. But, you know, laws and protections are there for the worst of the worst. The Constitution is not there for the most law-abiding citizen. The Constitution is for the worst case. But we have seen that, and this is the greatest problem to me of the criminal justice system as it relates to the death penalty, is it's a system run by human beings. Human beings make mistakes. And you cannot have a system that allows an innocent person to be killed. And on death row, in the last two decades, almost 160 people have been exonerated.
Richard Glossop may not be alive in a year.
Yeah.
Have you prepared for that moment?
I think it'll be very devastating. I do have hope that at the very least, if this series on Richard Glossop doesn't lead to him getting a new trial, which is, you know, what I think he deserves, at the very least, he won't be first on the execution list with all of this attention. But if he's executed, it'll be, you know, I will be heartbroken.
Joe Berlinger is the director of Killing Richard Glossop. It's a documentary on Discovery. It's just started streaming, and it's a look at the death penalty due process in a particular case in Oklahoma, but with all kinds of issues for the national death penalty debate. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you.
The Black Panther has been the protector of Wakanda for generations. A mantle passed from warrior to warrior. Now, because your friend murdered my father, I also wear the mantle of king.
You're listening there to Chadwick Boseman playing the Black Panther in his first ever movie appearance in last year's Captain America: Civil War. The Black Panther isn't a new character. He was a creation of Marvel legends Stan Lee and Jack Kirby back in the 1960s. But the super warrior of the fictional African nation Wakanda is back now, in a time when comic publishers are making their heroes more diverse, from a biracial Spider-Man to the Muslim Kamala Khan, a.k.a. Ms. Marvel. Last year, Marvel released its first Black Panther comic book since author Ta-Nehisi Coates took over the franchise in 2015. One thing Coates has done here is bring on fellow comic newcomers like journalist Rembert Brown to help write the new issues. Brown has previously covered politics, race, and pop culture for Grantland and New York Magazine. Today marks the release of Black Panther World of Wakanda number 6, The Return of Casper Cole. It's the first comic Brown has ever written, and he told John Hockenberry the deep roots of these characters made his work much more than just another checked diversity box for Marvel.
For me, the way I was approached to do the comic, it didn't really feel like I was jumping onto like a diversity train. Yeah. It was just like this was a character, like with the success of Black Panther in every wing of the Marvel Universe, right. The films, Ta-Nehisi's comics, like there was this character that, you know, because it was the Black Panther universe, go figure, was also a black character that got built out a little bit and was a character that had like a very short run in an earlier run, and then just kind of they never really did much with it and was a fan favorite. And I think that's why they're like, like I wonder what else we can do in this Black Panther universe. And so when it came to me and they asked me about it, and like I knew of the character in a very small amount, and when I kind of went back and did my research and read about it and thought of some of the parallels between the character and myself, I was like, this could actually be interesting, beyond just like a very cool experience for me to do, never having written a comic before.
Are there limitations to what you can do and how much of a storyteller you can be through characters like this because of the audience of comics, that the audience of comics hasn't traditionally been, you know, a diverse audience, an African-American audience, an African-American youth audience?
I'm very interested to see what the response is, because through writing online, writing for two mainstream publications, New York Magazine and Grantland, I have a lot of experience writing for non-black people.
Right, exactly.
Right. So that wasn't actually a worry for me. Like I've kind of embraced writing for all eyes, and you know, I embrace the role of coming at this from an educated outsider perspective, like not trying to write like a comic book writer, but also respecting the craft and learning the craft as I went along. And my editors, who live and breathe Marvel comics and know everything, they, you know, it wasn't like I went off for 3 months and came back and like, here's the comic. Like we were working along the way, so this is something that I'm used to. It's just a different medium.
But it's really an exciting time. As you say, you know, you're used to writing for non-black audiences. I mean, it reminds me of Jordan Peele. I mean, Get Out, it seems to me, is an example of a movie that crosses barriers and creates sort of like linkages that have never been possible before, and that the comic book is a place to do this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say between watching Get Out and then a show like Atlanta, these are both two works of art that can't be defined by one genre. There are moments in Atlanta where it's the funniest show you've ever seen, and then it's the most serious show you've ever seen. There are moments in Get Out where it's hilarious, and then you're terrified. And I think that that is a moment that is beginning to happen more and more, and I don't think it's very surprising that a lot of the people that are doing this are black artists like a Donald Glover, a Jordan Peele, who are very comfortable being black and talking about the black experience, but not having that get pigeonholed into it has to be only funny or it has to be only serious. And those were things that were in my head as I was doing this comic, because I didn't feel pressure to make it one thing. Like in the comic book format, like, lends itself to sometimes being tongue-in-cheek and sometimes being serious and sometimes having action and like all that. It felt, you know, even though I'd never done this before, it weirdly felt kind of normal and natural.
Is Casper Cole liberating as a project, as a character?
Yeah, I mean, it was like there were some parallels where I was like, I know how to kind of write this character. It's like the only thing they told me is like they gave me like where the character needed to begin, and they told me where the character needed to end. And outside of that, I kind of had free rein to tell a story and kind of develop his, you know, kind of his swagger and like how he talked to people. And like one thing about this character is that he lived in New York and had bouts of financial trouble and was often broke, but he's trying to overcome this, and he has back and forth issues with authority and wants mentors. And so I was like, I know what this is, and I felt like this character before. So it was liberating to be able to write like that, but also have him be, you know, have superhero abilities.
Sometimes the comic book world is criticized for doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again.
Uh-huh.
Is what you're doing actually moving the whole industry into a new world, a new dimension, a new set of stories?
What I do think is interesting is kind of what's happened the past 2 years, where you're getting, you know, a person like Ta-Nehisi Coates, a person like Roxane Gay, myself, people that came from one traditional world, a world of journalism that gave a lot of black writers a platform to tell all different types of stories. Like, I think it is interesting. Like, I wouldn't have done this if it wasn't for the two of them.
Right.
And seeing not only them have some success, but it being kind of this freeing project to go in a completely different direction that people are like, wait, why are they doing comics? But when you really think about it, it makes sense because it's just storytelling in another form. You know, I'm interested to see what directions things go. But I do think, like, at the most basic level, I think it's very cool that people like us are getting an opportunity to, you know, really step outside of our comfort zone and be educated in comics, but also be embraced by having our voice and putting it in this medium.
Well, Rembert Brown, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
That's Rembert Brown in conversation with John Hockenberry there. Rembert Brown is a journalist and co-author of Black Panther, World of Wakanda, number 6, The Return of Casper Cole, which comes out today. And here's something to take with you today. We can't talk about comics without mentioning a big milestone for the longest-running animated show in American history. It's the 30-year anniversary of The Simpsons.
So, my friends, let's just junk those Democrats and their bleeding heart smell fair program.
Dad, I had to listen to this jerk all morning. Can we listen to something else?
When I'm driving the car, I get to choose the radio station.
Hey, you can't have 30 years of Simpsons history without a little bit of Simpsons trivia, nerds. Here's one. Hey, you heard Springfield's knockoff version of Rush Limbaugh there in the clip. What's that conservative radio host's name in Springfield? Do you know it? If you do, send me a message on Twitter. You can always reach me there. I'm at Todd Zwillick. You might actually catch a few Simpsons retweets on there too. And I have a Simpsons calendar right here in the Takeaway Studios. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, the Mr. Burns of public radio. This is The Takeaway.